You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Folks, I have the, I have the base scanner hooked up right in front of the microphone here so that you can hear what it sounds like if anybody out there is talking on the radio. And that's just so that you can catch a little bit of what it is that you might be interested in. The bass and the handheld are both exactly the same in their capabilities. They're exactly the same in the quality. The base station will receive broadcasts from a farther distance. And I have it hooked up here with the antenna that comes with it. It comes with its own antenna that works really, really good. Now, the handheld has just a little, about a 6-inch rubber ducky antenna on it, and it's battery operated. So it will not receive stations as far away as the base unit will, but it will do everything else that the base unit will, and just as good. So if, you know... That's quite a ways away. Now, I have heard on this scanner that's sitting right here in front of this microphone, I have heard people go 10-7 in Camp Verde and Flagstaff, and I heard an airplane talking to the Phoenix airport from 150 miles east of Phoenix, which put it about 200 miles away from us. And when somebody goes 10-7 in Camp Verde, you're talking about 100 miles away, or at least 80. I mean, no problem whatsoever. Flagstaff is an hour and a half driving at the, just as fast as you can get away with. It's an hour and a half from here. So this little scanner with its own antenna that comes with it is hearing all of these broadcasts from as far away as 200 miles, which is just incredible. Now, you have to remember this is a rural area, so we don't get the kind of scanner activity that you could anticipate in Los Angeles or Kansas City or New York City or any place where there's a large population. We're in a rural area. There's about 7,500 people that live around this valley. And, you know, most of them don't live in the valley. They live outside the valley, but within, you know, radio distance. In the valley, I think maybe in Eager, there's maybe 2,500 people. And maybe in Springerville, about 2,000. So anyway, that's maybe all we're going to hear for a little while. But at least you got to hear something. So remember that you can have one of these scanners, and we're not going to order any more of the base. We're not going to order any more of the base scanners. We will order more of the handheld scanners. That's the station ID. That's how these automatic communications units ID their station, which has to be done every so often. So that's what you just heard. But remember, we will order more of the handheld scanners simply because they're less expensive, and a lot of people seem to rather have them than the base unit because they can take them wherever they go. And when they're at home...
Myself and 44 will be 10-7 at...
They can... plug them in to the AC power at home and put an outside antenna plug into the handheld, and it's the same as the base scanner. The base scanner is also a mobile scanner. In other words, it has the place to mount it into a mobile bracket underneath your dashboard on each side of the scanner, and you can make this base scanner a mobile scanner. And it's a great scanner. You just won't believe it when you see it. It's wonderful. When you hear something like that, it's somebody talking way, way far away.
This is 41 for information I need to relay to you.
The price is on the... I'm going to turn it down now, folks, because I got to tell you what the prices are and the address so we can get into tonight's broadcast. I'm not putting this on the air to disclose what's going on around here to the world. That's not why I'm doing it. Anybody with a scanner can hear these broadcasts anywhere. There's lots of people in this valley who have scanners who are listening to all of the activity all of the time. We do for a specific reason. And I think that most of you will want to for specific reasons also. You want to know what the enemy's up to. And by enemy, I don't mean the police department or the police officers or necessarily anybody else. I'm specifically talking about the federal Gestapo. If you have some local Gestapo, then, you know, you can handle that within your community. But the federal Gestapo is extremely dangerous. They're deadly. They kill people for nothing. Literally nothing. They are outlaws. And you need to know what they're up to before they get to your door. And the only way you can do that is with a scanner. So, if you would like to order one of the handheld scanners, they're $260 delivered to your door. That's post-paid, $260. The base units are $280. That's only $20 more. $280 delivered to your door. And you can send it in the form of a blank money order or cash to the hour of the time in care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940. That's P.O. Box 940. Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. That's the hour of the time, in care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. It's another good thing about scanners, is that you know what's going on, and if somebody needs your help, you know about it, and you can provide it. And another thing, you know what your buddies in law enforcement are driving the ambulance are doing. In a rural area like this, I have friends in the police department. I have friends in the DPS. I have friends in emergency services. I have friends in the forestry department. I have friends all over the place. You would be amazed at how many patriots there are, and you would also be amazed at who has absolutely no idea that they're patriots. And so we can sort of keep a friendly ear to them also and help them if they need help. So remember, we have these available. Now, I'm going to tell you something else. Here's another reason why you need to get a scanner. And if you can, you need to get a base scanner and a handheld scanner so that you can put the base at home. You can take the handheld with you when you go somewhere. And you will have a permanent unit at home that your family can listen to all the time. And you have a handheld unit that you can take mobile with you. Now, you need to read up on the laws in your state, because in some states, if you get caught in an automobile with a scanner, you can be arrested and taken to jail. So make sure that you understand what the law is. And in some states, it's not whether you're listening to it at all. It just has to be present in the car. So make sure you know what the law is, and make sure you know what you're doing when you use these things. Don't use them for illegal or unlawful purposes. Remember, me, William Cooper, the hour of the time, all of our organizations, we believe in the law. That's why we have taken the stance that we take. We are against tyranny. We are in support of the law. We are in support of the lawful government. We are in support of the Constitution for the United States of America and our state. And we will support all of those people who are also in support of the law. We will oppose anyone who is acting against the law or under the color of law in order to usurp the rights of the citizens of the states or to inflict tyranny upon us. Understand those things, folks. In Congress right now is a bill. I don't remember the number off the top of my head. I'll give that to you tomorrow night. There is a bill to outlaw scanners all across the nation. It looks like it might pass the House. If it passes the House and passes the Senate, you know damn well Bill Clinton's going to sign it. So before it becomes law, you need to get a scanner, because they cannot pass an ex post facto law. Do you understand what I'm talking about? What they will do is outlaw scanners from the time that that law is passed, and you will not be able to get one if they pass the law and inflict it illegally and unlawfully upon the citizens within the states. If somebody makes a scanner within your state and they sell it in the state to you, it's not engaged in interstate or international commerce. The truth is, the federal government has no control over that scanner. Only the state does. And if your state doesn't outlaw the scanners, then you have no problem. But if you attempt to purchase a scanner that has been engaged or involved in interstate or international commerce, then you could be breaking the law, because they have the right to legislate in those cases. So understand that. So remember, they're trying to pass legislation outlawing all scanners. So if you want one, you better get one now, because it looks like it might pass. They have a lot of support from a lot of people to outlaw scanners. Okay, here we go. Into our broadcast, I backed it up a little so that you didn't miss anything. And this might be the last night. I don't remember how long the ending of this goes, but this is the fifth broadcast of the Legality of Taxes Symposium that was recently conducted in Washington, D.C.
And there's a question for me. We have attended this very informative symposium, and we would like to know what is next. The IRS and the federal government have refused to acknowledge the invitation to attend and rebut the research presented here today. What happens next? It is very disturbing to me personally and to the foundation that we have presented this evidence to the government, the IRS, and to the heads of the political branches, to the president himself and to the leaders of the two houses of Congress. In May, again, in May, a very respectful letter submitting copies of these reports and requesting that they be here to participate in the symposium. We need to get to the truth. No response. In April, in early June, a follow-up letter. No response. It's a very serious matter. Jefferson said, when government steps outside of the boundaries that the people have put around government, when they take one step outside, he said, they take possession of a boundless field of power, not capable of definition any longer, no longer capable of definition. So fundamentally, it's a question of sovereignty. Who's sovereign? Are the people sovereign, or is the government sovereign? Can government act unrestrained, outside of the limits that we, the people, have placed around it? Very heavy question. It's not the first time that government has ignored, turned a blind eye and a deaf ear to the will of the people, as expressed in our constitutions, both state and federal. Government is, in the minds of many, out of control of the people. There is a need to bring them back under control, not just on this issue, but in many other issues. So it's a question, I think, what do ordinary citizens do? Ordinary non-aligned citizens do when they are confronted with governmental wrongdoing. Larry Becraft, as you have heard, was the attorney representing plaintiffs in a series of cases in 1985 and 86. I have reviewed those cases. I'm in my 20th year of closely evaluating governmental behavior, comparing that behavior with the constitutions, state and federal, and then confronting before the courts improprieties, conflicts, behavior by the government that seems to be outside of these boundaries. So I was very interested on the 16th Amendment on this issue. What have the courts said? What's happened in the courts? And so I reviewed these cases. I was delighted to see Larry Becraft's name as an attorney representing plaintiffs in most of those cases. And that's why he's here today. But as I was startled, stunned by what I'd read. It's clear if you read those cases, you line them up and you read one after the other, you see precisely when Bill Benson's evidence first made its way into a case. And when it was first presented, the argument of the attorneys was, there's no 16th Amendment. Look at all these procedural errors. And the courts ruled, Court of Appeals ruled, dismissing the cases based upon a doctrine, the doctrine of conclusive presumption. What they were saying was, look, the Secretary of State back in 1913 declared, proclaimed it ratified. The 16th Amendment was ratified. That's it. Case closed. It was interesting, as you read the cases, the attorney said, went back into court on another case, and they introduced another argument. And they said, but the Secretary of State committed fraud in making that proclamation. Now, this is a more serious charge, one that's more difficult for the courts to say, you know, to apply the conclusive presumption argument to. Dealing with fraud. And it was in those cases that the Federal Court of Appeals said, this is a political question. Can you imagine? Co-equal independent branch of the government, the judiciary, saying it's a political question. They're presented with the facts. They know what the law is. You apply the law to the facts. That's the job of the court. Fundamental role is of the judiciary, in my opinion, is to see that the other two branches, the political branches, are kept in their constitutional places. It's a political question. Go talk to Congress about it. And of course, we heard they went to Congress and they said it's up to the courts. Isn't one of the definitions of treason, I hesitate, I don't like to use the word, but isn't one of the definitions of treason when two or more of the branches work together, cooperate in a collective decision to deny people their constitutional rights? So what to do? Very disturbed that the federal government has not responded, either to Joe or to this foundation. What to do next? Here's what I will be recommending to the board of our foundation, the We the People Foundation for Constitutional Education, and the board of its sister agency or sister organization, the We the People Congress. One is an educational organization. Its sister agency, the Congress, is set up to lobby engage in political activism. But this is what I will be recommending as a result of what we've heard here today and yesterday. We'll be recommending that we do everything we possibly can in our power to get people across the country to demand that, you know, this. We have to. The way the system is designed to work, if you need reform, you can get reform through the political process. So we should go to the legislative branch, and we should put pressure on the branch to hold a congressional hearing on this evidence. And to issue a subpoena, get the most knowledgeable people from the government to attend and to argue against these conclusions. They could duck this organization, of course. They can duck the symposium. It would be more difficult for them to duck a congressional hearing and a congressional summons. But we should also, the way the system is designed to work, so let's respect it, of course. We can get relief. People can get relief through the judicial process. And what has come to mind is the approach that Vietnam veterans took on the Agent Orange issue. Individual Vietnam vets that couldn't get anybody's attention, you know, to their plight and to their problem. Individually, they filed lawsuits in federal district courts. It was well coordinated. All over the country, hundreds of lawsuits were filed, basically the same claims by different veterans. And of course, they were all consolidated before the D.C. Circuit. A lot of attention was devoted. Decisions were now being made in the courts with the glaring lights, cameras on them. They weren't making any decision in the dark, that was for sure. And the case got to the Supreme Court, and they won. I think maybe we need to do the same thing. People need to file cases in federal district courts across the country, trying to get a declaration, trying to get the courts to do their job, look at the facts, look at the law, what happened, was the 16th Amendment, declare whether it was properly and legally ratified or not, and declare whether or not there is a statute that compels people to pay, file and pay an income tax. We should do that. But this is a very heavy decision, obviously, for the political branches. They're going to need some encouragement, in my opinion. And I think we need to think about Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King when they were faced with uncivil and unjust laws and government. They developed a formula, Mahatma Gandhi did. He wrote it down, and he said, what's needed is a proactive He used the word militant. That's politically incorrect today. So we'll take the license and change his words slightly. He said we need a proactive or militant, nonviolent mass movement. He got it, and they won. Martin Luther King in 1953 wrote about Mahatma Gandhi in that formula and said his people, his followers, needed to apply the same formula, a proactive, nonviolent mass movement. And they were successful. So maybe it may come to this, I hope not, but it may come to civil disobedience on the part of American citizens. If Congress, if the political branches refuse, and we continue to get the insults that we've gotten from Congress and the judiciary, Joe Bannister and Bill Benson, Larry Becraft, Bill Conklin have gotten over the years on this issue, then maybe it will come down to some sort of civil disobedience, a la Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King. So, as a foundation, I will recommend is that we reserve the large ballroom for in this building here at the National Press Club at a day early in September, right after Labor Day, and we invite all of the good government, constitutional activism or constitutional activist organizations at the state level and at the federal level to send representatives to a summit meeting where an attempt is made to put a collective foot down against the tyrants of our day, just as our forefathers did in the Revolutionary War and as Mahatma Gandhi did as well. And between now and then, that day in September, we get this evidence out. We get these arguments out to all of these organizations. We ask them to send a representative. And we attempt to enlist the support of all right-thinking, concerned Americans through these organizations. They have been struggling against one issue or another, governmental wrongdoing in one form or another, for a long time. See if we can't... right is right. Maybe an income tax is the best way. Maybe it is good for America. But we live under the rule of law. Let the people's representatives debate that question, as apparently they did in 1909. And then let's follow the rule of law. Let's get the states to ratify it. But let's not tolerate the current situation any longer. There are simply too many people being hurt. So that's what I will do. That's what this organization will do next. We'll get that word out on our website, givemeliberty.org, get you to the website of these three organizations, the foundation, the Congress, and another organization called the All County Taxpayers Association. Between those three organizations, which it sort of represents a triple threat offense to governmental wrongdoing, but we'll get the word out, and we will schedule early in September a summit meeting, see if we can't get the support of many Americans behind an effort to get Congress to do their job and to get the courts to do their job, and to be prepared, should they fail, to perform the primary role that we've established for them, then to engage in, if we have to, hopefully it'll never come to this, but engage in some sort of civil disobedience. Are there any other questions before we close? Do we have time? Some time. Question, will Bill Benson tell us what he has suffered at the hands of the U.S. government, and what about his health? We'll close with then the rest of the story, as a famous American phrases it. Bill, why don't you share with us in the time remaining?
Mr. Chairman, before we continue, I think it's imperative that each of us in this room not wait until September, but start contacting our representatives now. Put them on notice starting right now. Tell 10 people and have them tell 10 more. Let's for September. Get into action the minute you get back to wherever you've come from, and we've come from all over many, many different states.
That's a good point. Begin now. It's not too soon to begin demanding of your representative that they schedule a hearing to get to the honest evidence. That's a good point. Did I see another hand? Yes.
I'd like to suggest that we have videotaped this proceedings here, and that we can get copies of this and get it on public access television to spread the word to the people, because we have to get the word out to the people across the nation. When we do that, we will gain support.
Well, it's appropriate at this point to extend a heartfelt thank you to C-SPAN for being here today. Thank you. And Bill, would you share with us, I guess while you're finding your way to the microphone, you told us that you had gathered this evidence at your personal expense and time, and that it was submitted to the courts and to all federal judges, all congressmen. Told us that there was no response, especially from Congress, but what was the court's response? And what happened to you? What's the rest of the story?
Okay.
The rest of the story, ladies and gentlemen, is that when I did the research on the 16th Amendment, when I file suit against the state of Illinois for corruption committed in that state, and why I believe that a sales tax that would give the states money to give back to the federal government, in my personal opinion, is wrong. And I can say that from experience, because while I was an investigator for the Department of Revenue, it was my duty and responsibility to collect the excise tax, the tax that you paid when you went to the gasoline station, the grocery stores, the liquor stores, or whatever commodities that you purchased. It was my bitter, bitter experience to find that some of these people that were involved in collecting the excise tax that you paid, after they owed about $3 million to $4 million, would come to the Department of Revenue and talk to the attorneys and say, look, let's make a deal. They sold $3 million cases down the river for $250,000. That's my fear with the sales tax. If it goes to the states to collect, the states are going to do nothing more. They'll have more money to play with than they had when I was with the Department of Revenue. When I began to talk about the 16th Amendment, when I began to before the book was even out, before I even got it from the printer, I was in the Mr. Beecraft's country, Birmingham, Alabama, giving a speech before a large number of people. I had the computer printouts of the research that I did in Volume 1. And I received a call that evening from Mrs. Benson, and she says, "It's extremely urgent that you call Washington, D.C. immediately." I had a home telephone number. I had two telephone numbers to contact an attorney who worked for a senator. And I said, as far as I'm concerned, I have far more important work than to contact that senator or contact his attorney right now. But I did it the next day. And lo and behold, to my amazement, I was told, and there's a third party witness to the telephone conversation who is a Baptist preacher. The attorney said, "Bill, we know what you're doing. You cannot," and believe me, he repeated, "you cannot permit that book to get into the hands of the kooks out there." I said, "Warren, as far as I'm concerned, there may be kooks out here, but the majority of the kooks are in Washington, D.C. and the Capitol." He said, "Do you not understand what I'm offering you?" I says, "Of course I do." He says, "Have all the books printed that you want. Name your price. We'll pay it. But then we want all of the certified, notarized documents that you have, and for you never, ever to again speak about the 16th Amendment." And I said no. He said, "Do you understand you never, ever have to work another day in your life? You can take care of your family." And I said, "What about the rest of the people in the country?" That's what this is all about. Not just about Bill Benson. It's about my children, my grandchildren, and every one of yours, every person in this country. I didn't do this piece of research work on the 16th Amendment because I was going to make money off of it. That was not the idea. There hasn't been any money made off of it. Everything's gone right back into what I'm doing as far as traveling, speaking, and etc. As I told you previously, won my case against state government, it was a bitter blow for them, very bitter, to have one individual like Bill Benson and one lonely attorney win a major case like we did from the state. The state of Illinois spent in excess of $2 million trying to fight and beat me, and they lost. I know the figure because I know where the records are. I know when they hire outside contractors, as far as attorneys are concerned, they must have invoice vouchers that they produce every month, and they must have contracts. So the state of Illinois, the capital of the state of Illinois, is Springfield, and I would go to Springfield and pull all the vouchers. So we kind of knew what those lawyers were doing a little bit before they were doing it. After the case was over, the government and one of the attorneys that was involved in the lawsuit, and he was very angry with me because I had arrested his secretary for... At that time, we were involved in excise tax as far as cigarettes are concerned, bringing them from one state to the other. My partner and I did not agree with the law, and we so made our objection to the director. The director said, "I want you to go out there on the 3rd and 4th of every month when those elderly people have their Social Security checks and purchase cigarettes and take their cars, lock them up if they have purchased enough. Because the law in the state of Illinois says that if you purchase 10 cartons or more, you're subject to arrest, confiscation of your vehicle, and then you have to go to court within 30 days. I used to post bond for some of these people because I did not agree. I had Chicago policemen, Chicago firemen, ambulance trucks that were coming out to the cigarette stands, and I said, no, this cannot be. If I have to arrest the individual in front of that policeman, behind that policeman, I'm going to arrest that policeman. At one time, I chased a Chicago sergeant in full dress uniform in a Chicago marked police car, and I had a siren and a red light in my car, in an unmarked car. I chased him at 90 miles an hour, and I knew I was going to catch him because he had to go through the toll gates. And we were not both going to go through there at that speed. I think it was foolish of me to do that, but my partner was behind me. He couldn't get ahead of me. When he stepped out of that vehicle, he says, "Don't you understand who I am? Do you see these stripes?" I said, "Sergeant, the only thing I want from you is your driver's license and your identification." I said, "I know how much you have purchased as far as cigarettes are concerned. You haven't purchased enough to break the law, or else your squad car would go into the sheriff's auto pond like everyone else's, and you would go to your precinct and be locked up in your own jail." That wasn't bold, I don't think. It wasn't trying to be a hero or a martyr or anything of the sort. It was being fair with each and every individual. Ambulances had no business out there. So, yeah, federal government, state government were very, very angry at Bill Benson. And in 1980, in the 1981, I had an insurance company settlement. And the attorney that worked the case that we won wrote a letter to the first assistant United States attorney, Joan Bainbridge Safford, in Chicago. And he says, "Dear Joan, I believe I know how to get these turkeys," including my lawyer and myself. He says, "and I'll help you in every way I can." So I was indicted for willful failure to file income tax returns for the year of 1980 and 81. I didn't have to file returns. There was no requirement to file returns for those years as far as that money is concerned. But they got to the insurance company. The insurance agent took the witness stand, and my attorney asked him, "Where is Mr. Benson's W-2, W-4? Where are all of his credentials that he has from your company? I want to see everything." He put his head down for a couple of minutes, and he said, nothing, for at least 2 minutes. The attorney said, "Do you not understand my question?" And he says, "Yes." He said, "I lied when I testified before the grand jury." With that case should have been thrown out, period. But it was not. Judge Paul Plunkett said maybe he lied and maybe he didn't after the jury was sent out of the room, and there was a big argument. And then, of course, the transcript was read back from the court reporter. And he says, "This case is going ahead." To make it a little bit shorter, the jury did find the guilty because I didn't file a tax return. And I spent 15 months and 5 days in prison in Rochester, Minnesota. After 15 months and 5 days, the appellate court for the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals reversed my case. The government was still going to get me one way or the other if they could. They went to the judge and said that Mr. Benson has filed an appeal before the appellate court. It would be like OJ saying, I have just been found not guilty. Let's try it again. Maybe you can find me guilty. When you have a reversal like that, when your case is reversed, you win. The government has to go back in to the appellate court and try and win their case back against you so maybe they can prosecute you. And they did that. They not only went to the three-judge panel, were denied after a period of time. They went to the embanked panel, then the proper panel to go through, and they were also denied. Then they went to the clerks of the court. Instead of going to the Supreme Court, it was our only option, and said, we want you to set this case for a new trial. And the clerk says, no, we cannot, because it's been reversed. So they went to one judge in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, Judge Mannion. Judge Mannion then changed the order and said it shall now read reversed and remand. So I find myself back into court a second time. Now, I'll back up a little bit, because the first time I was in prison, in 1968, I became ill with encephalitis. That's caused by a mosquito bite. And a lot of times it causes you to have seizures. It causes you to sleep a long time during a day, maybe 2 days at a time or so. And the government and the institution knew that. I was doing very, very well with the prescribed medication by the doctors. But when I got into the institution, they took the medication away. And they said, we're going to give you something that's going to take care of your problem. I said, no, you're not. I'm not going to accept it. I had four guards walk into my room, because they didn't call your room a cell. It was a room. It was something you took care of, if you could, and the whole thing. And the four guards held me down. Three nurses came in. Three nurses were all over my body. And when I got hit with a needle, that was goodbye. The inmates got a hold of my small telephone book and called Mrs. Benson and told her, you better get into this institution to find out what's happening to Bill. I had edema so bad, I was three times the size that I am now. They couldn't put clothes on me. I couldn't see. I couldn't hear. I couldn't walk. I couldn't talk. When Mrs. Benson got in, the doctors and the warden fought like crazy to keep her from seeing me. But she fought just as hard, and she got to see me. My daughter was 38 years old, and I didn't know her. When the question was asked, would I do it all over again? You bet I would. In a heartbeat. There is no question about it. Because this issue of the income tax, the 16th Amendment, the government cannot prove me wrong. From 1981 to present day, I haven't been bothered by any of them. From 1981 to present day, no one has said, Mr. Benson, where's your tax return? No one has come to the door, knocked on the door, and said, Mr. Benson, we want to talk to you. No one. Who is right? Are they right? I personally made a copy of all 17,000 documents for the federal court, for the judge, and for the prosecutor. And they still have them in their possession since 1987. See, they indicted me for 1980 and 1981, but not until April 13th of 1987. I was their poster boy because of the publicity as far as Volume 1 is concerned. That gave them a lot of problems. No ifs, ands, buts, or questions about it. It was a horrible experience to go through because I ended up in a wheelchair for 2 years for fighting for what was right, for fighting for what I proved, for fighting for what I knew they could not disprove.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have to make a correction here. A few minutes ago, Bill Benson said the first time he was in prison in 1968, he meant to say 1988. And that's the story that he was talking about. He's an old man. And when you see the videotape, and by the way, you can order it from us at the same address I gave earlier for $20 postpaid to your door, the two videotape set for $20. But you'll see on the videotape that all of these years of fighting the government has taken its toll on Bill Benson. The correct year was 1988, not 1968.
Any sort of a bribe from a government official, that was not going to happen. 2 years was a long time, 15 months and 5 days in the institution. The parole board on September the 27th had already paroled me, but the appellate court had reversed the jury's guilty verdict. And what did they say? I want you to listen to this. The judge had abused his discretion in permitting the testimony to go on the way he did. He tainted the minds of the jurors by listening to the IRS special agents. We must reverse Benson. So, when I left that institution, then I found myself back into court again. We went back in, I was tried a second time, found guilty again the second time, same old, same old, same case, same everything, denial of due process. We have heard denial of due process for the last couple of days, and that's exactly what they did, denial of due process. We argued due process with the judge, with the United States Attorney's Office for many, many months. That we were in court in September of last year, and we had explained to the judge, I had served all my time, you cannot do anything, because they wanted to put me back in prison for 22 days. And they did. And they then sent me to Fort Worth, Texas. Fort Worth, Texas said, we believe there's a very serious problem here, and this institution is not going to become involved in a false imprisonment lawsuit. And a receiving and discharge clerk says, nor either am I. We now have an order from Judge Grady that says, it was unlawful for me to put Mr. Benson in prison. It was unlawful for me to put Mr. Benson on 5 years of probation because, you see, they wouldn't let me leave the Northern District of Illinois to talk to people like you, to go anywhere, to even visit my children, my grandchildren in the state of Michigan, Arizona, and California. They refused to permit me to go anywhere. Now, on my desk at home is a lawsuit prepared against these government officials. And as soon as I get home, I will be in federal court and file it. So David can beat Goliath. Thank you.
We do salute you, Bill Benson. And with that, we want to thank all of you people who have come from states all over the country. We thank the panel members for participating, and time will tell. Good luck in all that you do. Stay well and stay vigilant.
And that's it, folks. That's the end of the symposium. So, let me tell you once again, if you'd like to purchase the two video tape set, which took up 5 hours of the hour of the time. Remember, we started last Wednesday, I believe it was. So it's Wednesday, Thursday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. That's 5 hours of the hour of the time, just the audio track. If you would like to have the two video tape set, send $20, that's postpaid, to your door in a blank money order or cash only. Remember, if you fill out that money order, we will not accept it. And send it to the hour of the time in care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. That's the hour of the time. In care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. Good night, folks. God bless each and every one of you. Good night, Annie. My daughters, Dorothy and Allison. I love you all. I miss you so much that I can't even express it. You're in my thoughts always. May God bless you and keep you safe. Thank you.
no love.
Thank you, Tim, for all your help. Pauline, Jeff, Glenn Jacobs, Nolan Udall. And, of course, my brother Doyle. Without all of you, I wouldn't be accomplishing anything today. So once again, thank you from the bottom of my heart.
To be born, dance me through the curtains that our kisses have outworn. Raise the tent of shelter now, though every thread is torn. And dance me to the end of love.
Oh, and folks, you need to know, today, without any warning whatsoever, and without a ruling, as they promised, the factory sent us a brand new television transmitter. A brand new television transmitter. We're not going to make the same mistake again, though. We have ordered it.